There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Man, I'm talking about Mr. Charles. I'm talking about Mr. Manson.
Those are my lyrics.
That's a good song.
It's a good song.
Man, can you imagine what his underwear smells like?
Oh my goodness. Well-treaded grass. Disgusting.
For some reason, I think about that all the time when it comes to, like, you know, either our founding fathers or, like, the president. Like,
right.
What is Obama's balls smell like?
I bet he probably has the nicest smelling balls of any president in U.S. history. There's
pristine,
no doubt about it.
Like two onyx orbs
right.
Made of just of a unicorn hoof.
Yeah, definitely. And
yeah,
then, of
Charles
course,
Manson smell like a gin-soaked bramble bush.
Yeah, and then Roosevelt is somewhere in the middle there.
Can you imagine Roosevelt?
Yeah, wheelchair nuts. wheelchair nuts have to smell the worst out of all the nuts. There's no doubt about it. You can only get him cleaned once every 3 days.
Absolutely, because it's a problem. It's because Eleanor hated lifting his ankles above his ears in order to get to him. Because she's just like, oh, better get to him. Oh, look at they're getting greener than normal.
And that's been this week in Last Podcast on the Left, Presidential History. Welcome to the show, everyone. That's Marcus Parks. I'm Ben Kitzel. We're joined all the way from Los Angeles by...
Yeah, Charles Manson.
Charles, you're there. You're out of the pokey. You're out of the pen.
I stole the rap on the street. That's what I know. Yeah, I was born with a knife in my hand, and I got diamonds in my shoes. Ah, Charles Manson.
Sounds like you just sell your shoes.
Oh, no.
He just has, like, the greatest frozen in time the vocabulary.
He does.
Like, possible. Like, as we watch, as you're going to listen to this episode, Charles Manson is such an interesting character a person.
He's like a...
Of course.
He's sort of a jazz musician, kind of a serial killer, or not even a serial killer, kind of a, you know, he's a bebop kind of guy.
Boy, we went across America, and we was on this trip that, man, it was a jive.
Right, then what'd you do? We stabbed a bunch of women. Oh, okay.
Stabbed a bunch of women.
I thought you were going to go on.
Yeah, that wasn't my fault. That wasn't my fault.
Right. So in case
everyone
you have...
I ever slept with was born with a mustache.
All right, so obviously we're talking about Charles Manson today. And Marcus, once again, crack job on the research.
Thank you, sir.
Amazing stuff. Let's just start. At the beginning of his life, which, man, this guy did not have a lot of chances.
He began his life as No Name Maddox in 1934. Right. That is the name on Charles Manson's birth certificate.
So his name is No Name.
Yeah, his name, his given name is No Name. That's how he started life.
The big thing with Charles Manson that is very interesting is that he's different than any other big hitter that we've ever covered in terms of, like, he had definite goals. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a person that, like, he's a con man. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see that as we lay out basically a kind of our thesis here at Last Podcast is that Charles Manson is not necessarily, like, he's not a Dahmer. Like, he's not a John Wayne Gacy. He's just a con man that was always looking for his next game. And then it just so happened to be that the game changed.
Right.
The game around him changed. And he was just now in for the ride if he wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah. He's a lot like Kurt Cobain. You know, he was just the most charismatic person on the scene and they made him the star. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Kurt Cobain killed himself. But Manson lived.
Manson lived and he still lives. And he's still fucking hard as a rock. He's in there having sex with 25-year-olds. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't believe Manson is a sociopath. I don't think he's a psychopath.
He is a sociopath. He is a sociopath.
You think he's a sociopath?
Yes, because he suffers from the same things that they basically talk when you're looking for a sociopath. He's glib. He's really good on the front of, like, talking to people and stuff like that. He does not feel consequences for his actions. When you read the book Manson in His Own Words, which is fantastic.
It's so good.
When do you get an autobiography written by the killer? You know what I mean? Like, it's very rarely happens. And so he is, but in this, you basically just, he has no feelings, really.
I don't know. But, to me, it seems like he's got quite a bit of love in his heart.
All right. So let's have the audience decide. One thing we know for sure, as we'll get into here.
Marcus has a lot of compassion for Charles Manson.
He does. It's a creepy amount. I have to be in studio with him, Henry, so at least you're an entire coast away. So you're safe. You're fine. Maybe don't come back for a couple of days. Marcus might be going on one of his sprees. But like all sociopaths and serials,
I'm putting my street front girl. This is my street front girl.
I'm going to be wearing a dress on the corner.
Leave Jackie alone.
Yeah, exactly. Jackie and I are going to be whoring out for Pimp Marcus, paying him in burritos.
I mean, come on, guys. Has there actually ever been a musician that was a sociopath? Think about it.
No, not Bono.
Think about it.
It's not Bono. But like all the heavy hitters we've talked about previously, his childhood was extremely abusive and extremely traumatic, and he was really birthed into the world with a the doctor had steel hands. It was a cold world for the poor boy.
He was born.
So his doctor was Colossus?
Yes, that's correct. He was he's one of the best, but also the worst doctors in America. But he's the worst doctor in America, best doctor in Russia.
He was born to a prostitute named Kathleen, although Charlie says she wasn't a prostitute. Charlie calls her a flower child of the 30s, 30 years ahead of her time.
The flower child? What would that
so
even be?
So a prostitute. Yeah. He needs a prostitute because it only existed during the flower child era.
Yeah.
I would also say that what I also love in Manson's own words, because he talks about his mom. She's like, now my mama, yeah, ha-ha, she would go around and say, yeah, she was a friend of a man. Oh, friend of and many a man. But what do you call her, a prostitute? No, no, no. Maybe she sold her body a little bit.
Right.
You never call. Cause he loves his mother.
Yeah,
he does.
Yeah, he does. And we're going to be taking a lot of this stuff from Manson in his own words. I did cross-reference a lot of this stuff that he said with other sources, and let's just say they don't always match up.
Right.
No, but
right.
Who are you going to believe? You going to believe Charles Manson, or are you going to believe some fucking dickhead DA named Vincent Bugliosi?
Bugliosi? Yeah. Yeah, buddy, get behind the curtain, start wearing a mask, go be on Broadway. Way, you sound like a phantom. Okay,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
Ridiculous.
It sounds like an Italian horror screen star.
Bugliosi.
So Kathleen, she sued. We don't know who Manson's father is for sure. All we know is that she sued a man named Colonel Scott.
I will say
it's
this:
rough when your name is Colonel, you know,
yeah.
You were given the name Colonel as a boy. That just shows.
Well, we actually don't know what his first name was. That was just the name on the lawsuit. It was Colonel. First name unknown, Scott.
Is it possible that his father is Woody Allen? I'm just throwing it out there.
She
could be the guy from Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Ah, the Colonel.
So she was awarded a lump sum of $25 plus $5 per month to raise little Charlie.
Which really isn't that bad of a deal back in 1930s, right?
Yeah, 1934 was when Charlie was born. Yeah. So Kathleen, she came from an extremely strict Christian household. She was rebelling against her parents. Her mother believed that the showing of an ankle was sinful and makeup was evil, only used by hookers. Kathleen had Charlie when she was 15. That whole Christian trip, that's going to come in that's going to come in a little bit later as far as how it affected Charlie.
And this is for the parents out there. So if you could, sometimes you got to let your kids go out and look like whores.
That's
you know
right.
What I mean? Like sometimes you just got to go out there, let them go out and dancing around, show that midriff, all right? Because it keeps them from having a Charles Manson later on in life.
That's right.
Yeah, where the name Manson comes from was from a dude named William Manson, who was much older than her, lived with Kathleen shortly after Charlie was born. He convinced her to marry him, which was not a good idea.
How difficult was that?
Yeah, a 16-year-old girl with a 1-year-old son named No Name.
Right. I mean, if she says no to him, he needs to off himself immediately.
Actually, no, it wasn't No Name. It was Noname. It was Swahili for uncared for child.
Feet, yes.
Yes, and Charlie said he didn't know whether the divorce was his fault or his mom's, but he placed most of the blame on her. He said, you know, she was always a promiscuous little broad.
Yeah.
One of mom's relatives delighted to tell the story of how my mother once sold me for a pitcher of beer. Mom was in a cafe one afternoon with me in her lap. The waitress, would-be mother without a child of her own, jokingly told my mom she'd buy me from her. Mom replied, a pitcher of beer and he's yours. Waitress set up the beer. Mom stuck around long enough to fidget off and left the place without me. Several days later, my uncle had to search the town for the waitress to take me home.
Some families have,
and that is verbatim from Charlie Manson.
Some
in
families,
his own words.
Some families have like game night. And then this family was just like, leave the baby at the bar for a pitcher or beer night. And that's kind of fun.
So I will tell you that if I've been at the bar several times and have been broke, mm-hmm. and if I had a child and could, and in that moment,
right.
you asked me to give up the child for straight booze, because the booze helps you forget you even had a kid.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah.
I would do it.
I agree. I would say it's probably Charles's fault that they got a divorce, because I cannot imagine that someone's like, I would marry you, but you don't have a one-year-old. And I'm really looking for a woman who has an annoying piece of baggage with her at all times.
So not a kid that's literally been like a professional pickpocket since the age of 4 years old.
Right, right.
So Kathleen, not surprisingly, was sentenced to 5 years in prison for armed robbery pretty soon after the bar incident. So Charlie went to go live with his overly religious aunt, the Jesus. Sister of Charlie's mom, and a sadistic uncle until his mother got out of prison. And when she got out of prison, he describes it as the happiest day of his life. She got out when he was 8. But his
this
uncle,
is a mother who sold him for beer.
Yeah.
That's how bad his uncle was. That when she got out, he's like, thank God, maybe I'll be sold for whiskey this time.
And the reason why his uncle was sadistic and his he... And the first day of school, apparently Charlie was a bit of a sensitive child, bit of a crybaby. So his uncle was of the mindset of, you're going to be a little crybaby? I'm going to treat you like a crybaby. You're going to be a little girl? I'm going to treat you like a little girl. So on Charlie's first day of school, his uncle dressed him in girl's clothing.
And I just want to say, that that's actually a very progressive thing for his uncle to do. And I don't believe the gender norms need to be necessarily applied to children at a young age.
Yeah, where did he grow up? In Fort Greene, Brooklyn? That sounds amazing.
I mean, I'm looking at these kids.
What I will say, though, they talk a bit of an interview with his aunt. And his aunt was like, Charlie hated going to church, but he loved to sing. What a beautiful voice Charlie had.
Right.
It's amazing.
Oh, my God. So after she got out of prison at 8, they traveled around the country for a few years, just bouncing from man to man. She tells us, Charlie tells a story that her mom, that one night, her mom hit a guy in the head, like the badass guy in town. He grabbed her ass. She hit him over the head with a bottle of whiskey, and she said, Charlie, we gotta go. And immediately they were out of town. And that was the life that Charlie lived for a few years. But, man, loved it.
That's called an Alabama wedding. If you grab a chick's ass and she smashes a beer over your head, you're married.
You owe her money. The other thing, too, is that Charlie during this time was also becoming, like, he even called himself like a bit of a rambunctious child, is that he has been developing criminal skills,
right.
basically watching his mother throughout this whole process. And like every one of her new boyfriends would all kind of say the same thing. I can't be with this woman and her creepy kid.
Creepy
she kept
kid.
Calling him like either creepy kid or like kid who's like guy like sneaking around.
Yeah, sneaky was another word that he used.
Because he would go in and he would pickpocket and stuff. So basically, Charlie Manson is the perfect mixture of all of the skills it takes to be a criminal.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a newsie. Doesn't he sound like a little British kid who's about to jump on a soapbox and try to sell the papers?
He's more of a chimney sweep than anything, but which we'll find out about when we go to the UK. We'll have to watch our wallets, won't we, boys?
Yes.
Yes, we will.
But really, I mean, you know, Charlie, at this point, you can still claim that he's innocent. He's just a child following his mother's lead. I'm sure she's like, steal that guy's money. You know, I'm going to blow him. You steal his money. It was kind of sweet.
A little
in
bit.
In a weird way, you know?
It's a little kind of, it's kind of Harold and Maudie. A little bit.
Yeah.
So after a few years, she gets tired of him when he's 12. She goes to a judge, says, listen, I can't take care of this kid anymore. Put him somewhere else. They send him to a boy's home. He escapes from the boy's home. The mother rejects him, says, no, listen, I don't want you. Go back to the boy's home. And so after he's there for a little bit, after his mother rejects him, he goes back, he escapes, and he goes to Indianapolis to live on the streets. So this kid, Charlie Manson, at 12, he's living on the streets of Indianapolis trying to survive.
Why would he go to Indianapolis?
Closest city.
Okay.
Because he said in Manson's own words that he went to Indianapolis because he knew that it's much easier to hide from the law in a big city than out in the country, which is also just like a ridiculous thought for a 12-year-old to be able to have. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He knew that. But he was living on his own for like 6 months. He like was stealing whatever money he could and living in a tiny apartment. He was doing better than you, Kissel.
Yeah, that's amazing. 12 years old. I can't believe he was able to get renter's insurance.
He had his own place.
Wow, all the ladies coming through there. He was driving, huh?
Yeah, well, it was a stolen car.
Well, nonetheless.
But he had a car. He was.
God,
a,
this is adorable.
Yeah, it is kind of adorable. He's kind of an adorable man.
This is the,
it's
the movie.
It's kind of like Charlie's Day Out.
Charlie's Day Out. He's like that problem child kid. He's just, yeah, man, what a hell of a 12-year-old.
And exactly what the problem child kid would have grown up into.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it wouldn't have ended in murder, Charlie Manson would have been a really fun guy to talk to at the bus stop.
Yeah. But then you also, like, at the end of it, you're like, are you waiting for a bus? No.
I'm afraid of buses. Legally allowed on a bus.
So, yeah, he goes back to reform school.
Also, like, if this was, like, 1880, he could have been president.
You know,
how many presidents also started like this?
So many.
So he goes back to school. He escapes with wire cutters at one point and leads 35 juvenile delinquents out onto the streets of Indianapolis. Most of them got away. He got picked up 2 hours later in a stolen car. And that's when they send him to, I think, one of the places that fucked him up the most, the Indiana School for Boys.
Yeah,
it was a reform school, a state school, and he was abused by correctional officers and fellow inmates for 3 full years. He said that the only good thing he could say about it is that they had an impressive front lawn.
They must have. The Little Rascals comes to mind. How did he even reach the pedal? What is he? He's like 5'4" as an adult. When he was 12, he had to be like 4'8".
Yeah, he was a tiny guy. That's another thing that people don't realize.
He's
so small.
He was 5'5". My goodness.
And so there's also what's interesting about this time period, too, is that he keeps calling back to this time period as being like basically Indiana School for Boys was so rough that it set several patterns where it made every other prison that he served time in feel like a vacation home.
Yeah.
And so it was easy for him to do time. And it also basically showed he's been kind of given a bad hand. Charlie was given a bad hand since the very beginning. Like, he was like, he's grew up as a kid, basically forced to be a criminal. And now that past is going to haunt him through this whole thing and basically set up his whole fucking life for him. Because basically, he walked into the Indiana School for Boys with a reputation as being a hellraiser. And so the guys who ran the Indiana School for Boys were decided, we're going to beat the fucking hellraiser out of Charlie.
Yeah. One of them picked up raw silage from the dairy floor because apparently they had a dairy there. He spit tobacco juice in it in the silage, and then he shoved it up Charlie's ass, saying, "I got him lubed, so fuck him if you get the chance."
Ah, the old 1700 proctology exam.
Yeah, because apparently the whole thing is that the officers of the Indiana School for Boys would get snitch kids. Basically, get snitch kids to rat out other kids that were doing bad things, and then they would turn their back. The counselors would then turn their back when those kids raped the other boys.
Right. Yeah. See, that's the thing. Snitches get stitches, but in this situation, they got extra cheese sandwiches. So sometimes you get extra cheese.
So it's sick. And he also definitely had retribution. One of his rapists, he actually almost beat him to death with an iron bar, and then framed one of his other rapists for the crime.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I mean, he definitely got some revenge in there.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man, you put a laugh track underneath his life. This is funny. This is
you
humorous.
Know, it's technically like the story of Arthur Fonzarelli.
Mm-hmm. Hitting jukeboxes, getting to play. Technically theft of services, by the way.
So at 16, Charlie escapes, makes it as far as Utah. And so they take him out of the state reformatory and then throw him into a federal reformatory, which he describes as much nicer.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's a lot more oversight in the federal reformatory.
Sure.
So that's, you know, he's moving on up as far as the federal, as far as the prison system goes.
Nicer literally just means that no one put silage mixed with chewing tobacco up his ass.
Exactly.
Ass. So anything also, is nicer.
I
just skipped all the different various, like, you know, they forced him to work dairy. He was beaten with a cane, like, every other day for any offense.
Yeah.
And then the guys who ran the dairy was this sick fuck who would just, like, would work him really hard to the point where his welts from the being caned were bleeding and like actively while he was doing the work, and he would have the boys come and smack his ass as he was working.
Oh, these corrections officers are total sadists and psychopaths and pedophiles. They're all They would have loved to be in that Franklin Credit Union. That's for damn sure.
Yep. He said that he had strong sexual urges that got him into trouble from time to time. He said at this point, the only climaxes he's had was from, quote, jacking off or sticking some punk in the butt.
Right, right.
Yeah, he said, do you want to
take... It's weird, though. He seems to transcend. We'll get into it. He doesn't seem to be gay. It's like a different kind of thing.
It's a weird thing. Like, it's just one of those things where a hole.
This sort of like the Michael Che joke, who's now the SNL Weekend Update guy, where he talks about how you can't catch gay. You can only catch gay in prison.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what happened to him.
Yeah.
Think about it. He had spent his formative years from the ages of 12 to 16 in boys' homes, where it's like basically he was jammed into these places where all of these kids were sexually developing, and they were just like, get a booger.
Yeah.
Like all over each other, and that's got to be dangerous.
I mean, they say that this even happens. There's this open secret in British boarding schools that those kids there, they, you know, generally fuck each other with a fair regularity.
That's not a secret. Yeah.
Yeah, man, that's why I just want to see the secret files of the damn Dumbledore. I want to go over to Hogwarts and see them tiny wizards all crawling all over each other, combing on each other's cone hats and sticking the wands up inside themselves.
Yeah, you don't want to activate that wand, though. It turns your prostate into a gerbil. That would be terrible. Yeah, that Jimmy Savile has nothing on that Dumbledore. That would be crazy.
Yeah. So it's a matter of record that Charlie was caught having sex with a younger inmate while he held a razor to his throat. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, a lot of people say that was one of Charlie's first violent acts. That was when he had been pushed too far. But here's what Charlie says about that particular incident.
I was accused of holding a razor blade. This kid's throat. I screwed him in the ass. Truth was, the guy was an undercover queer, and he wanted a dick in his ass. And I didn't mind doing it to him. We both agree that if we got caught, he could say I forced him. We got caught.
Sounds like it, Charlie. So you're sticking with your story that he was an undercover queer. Like, yeah. the gay community sent him in there to bust you.
Yeah, he said, I didn't have any respect for a joint punk then, and I don't now.
No, he does not.
No, he does not.
No, he doesn't. No, and he should have because they deserve it.
God, 5'5", man. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing that he was able to survive at all in these situations, really. Yeah.
He said
that's what he says, talks about that all the time, honestly. Yeah. He said because of his size, he had to do everything to an extreme.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He had to always show people that he was fucking nuts in order to – and basically, he even says it in this thing, and it's true. It's kind of like that Kurt Vonnegut quote of being like, you know, we are who we pretend to be, but you must be careful who you pretend to be.
Yeah.
Where it's like he basically created this image for himself that he was this crazy, like, fucking maniac, and then eventually begin to believe it.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And like, he was like in some sort of involuntary institution from the ages of 12 to 19.
Right.
Like, he was either in a boy's home or in a reformatory from 12 to 19.
Now, when I was 12 to 19, I was looking up to, like, Chris Farley, John Starks. What were some of his idols?
He was looking up to any criminal that happened to be in front of him that could give him any hint into what life could be like for a person like him.
And these were like his teen beat.
These were his idols. Like, everyone else looks up to sports stars.
Right.
He looked up to criminals, like members of the Mob Barker gang. Like, he just looked up to these people like they were the end-all, be-all. Mm-hmm. Like, this is who he idolized himself after.
Right.
So, 1955, he married the first woman he slept with and moved to California. Of course,
And the way he describes her, too, it's just like, she wasn't much of a piece. But I have you know, her silky smooth skin was better than any rough bars of any prison I've ever been in.
Baby, you're better than prison bars. Oh, Charlie.
Oh, I love you.
I would just love the moment where he's bringing the razor up to her neck and she says, shh, don't.
Hey.
I don't gotta do
you're
that.
You're as ugly as a dog and you got a hair in your lip and you got a butt the size of Mississippi. But I will say is I will sleep with you.
Thank you, Charlie.
So, of course,
thank you, Charlie.
Can't believe it.
So, of course, well, actually, what you guys just said, that exact thing will happen later on.
Oh, very
like
good.
Like that exact oh, yes. situation yeah. right up to the copious body hair.
Mm-hmm.
So he has no skills outside of prison life. So, of course, he returns right to crime, gets the woman pregnant, and at 21, he gets arrested for car theft, sentenced to 5 years at Terminal Island, which he called, quote, a paradise.
He loved
this
it, huh?
Saying, the Indiana School for Boys made everything else easy
yeah,
right. for him.
Everything. So while he was in jail, his wife took his son and left him for a truck driver. He was never in contact with his first wife or his son ever again. And of course, he wanted to go straight, you know, while he was in family. I'm going to fucking get my life together. I'm going to get out. I'm going to get a good job. Of course, the wife and kid leave. So he says, fuck it. I'm going to become a pimp.
But you learn this a lot with him is that he has a lot of these moments, which I think is very common in people that are lifelong criminals, where he basically is being like, I'm going to go straight. I'm doing this. I'm going on the straight and narrow. I'm going to be a good citizen from here on out. And then it takes it's just really the tiniest reasons that him to go like, well, fuck life. Fuck these.
It's not even a tiny reason. He didn't, first of all, in this reform school, they didn't exactly teach him anything.
No.
And,
no.
I'm shocked, you know. The U.S. reform system is so unbelievably educational, but there is no choice. What's his other option?
No, he
can't
no
get a job bagging groceries.
Yeah,
this weird 5'5" guy walks into your Costco. Can I touch the produce? No, get out of here. Go steal a car.
Yeah,
so, you know I could use my mind to rearrange these peanuts for free.
So he has a dream of being a pimp, and he gets out and he becomes a pimp. And I love how he described it. He described being a pimp as being the bank president of crime.
Oh, wow.
That's how low Charlie's expectations were.
I think the bank president is the bank president of crime.
Yeah, I think so. But you know what? He was and this is not surprising, considering what became of his female followers later on in life. He was a fucking amazing pimp.
In what way? How was he so good?
He was
because he would ask all this advice as to how to use this, like, how do you turn a girl out? And like to other pimps in jail, they're just like, what you gotta do is you gotta get in that girl's head, make her love you more than anybody else, tell her that you love her more than anybody else, about how love your is, how deep and powerful your love is compared to anybody else's, and then tell her to sell her pussy on the street.
Oh, wow.
Like, that was the advice. And so he
and it worked.
I think that's how Simon Cowell treated Kelly Clarkson after she won American Idol.
But he was talking about with his friend, because he was like basically this like pimp philosophy about how like you could like all women want to do it.
Yeah.
And it's right. So fucked up because according to Charles Manson, he had a girlfriend as soon as he got out of jail and they were out of money. And he was just like, baby, I've been hustling and stealing for us. But I don't think we're making ends meet. It's like, will you sell your pussy for me?
Right.
And she was like, sure thing, Charlie.
Yeah.
You bet.
But the way he also described it, he's like, man, I was sitting in that car. I felt so bad about it. And she came down and, boy, she loved it.
She loved every second.
She just had a great time.
He's like a developer who walks around and he's like, I'm going to build a building there. And he sees the future. He sees money wherever he looks.
Also, it's also Charles Manson's fucking perspective.
Yeah.
That, right. Like, women just loved it. The women were so happy to be prostitutes.
They were crying and crying and crying. They must have loved it.
So he unfortunately transported some girls across state lines to take him to some conventions. So he's
conventions? Were they going to Comic-Con?
Yeah,
what were they?
Conventions. Yeah, it's like the fucking Republican National Convention. Remember when it came to New York?
Uh-huh.
And there was a flood of prostitutes in the town.
Oh, okay.
That's what
you remember,
Ben.
I remember. Yeah, I was one of the prostitutes.
So Charlie, he goes down to Mexico City, where he says he partied and mingled with bullfighters, who taught him how to use a cape and a sword. He took mushrooms.
They didn't understand a damn word he said. So yeah, man, you don't understand what I'm talking about with squeeze shoes.
just flapping a cape and a bull, and they're all just staring at him, just being like, "You've got to get out of here."
Yeah, bull scared of me, man. I can talk a bull's language. Watch me go, moo, moo. Moo, hey there, bull. Hey, moo, moo.
All right.
Will you please go?
So, yeah.
So we will stop our Mexican act if you please leave. Okay? We're all just brown Americans. So please get out of here.
So he hooks up with some Yaqui Indians, gets some mushrooms from them, and he develops a reputation as a real tough gringo, which brings the federales down on him. They send him back to the U.S. U.S. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Yaki Indians, the story with Yaki's Indians is so stupid. It's he's just like, they're like, everybody said, oh, better not go to those Yaki Indians. That's the only way you can get mushrooms from the Yaki Indians. But they hate white people. But I was like, oh, I'll show you. I walk right up to them Yaki Indians. And they're like, who are you? Why here? Please leave. And he's like, I'm your friend. I'm your buddy. Yeah, I'm doing mushrooms, man. He's like, mushrooms are for spiritual exercise. Please leave, tiny white. No, man. No, you and me. And then he was just like, and so it's like, I wanted to show them I had a gun for trade. So I pulled a gun out of my pants and I pointed the gun in the Indian's face. And he was like, no, please do not shoot. We'll give mushrooms. And he's like, no, man, it's for you. It's for you. And I put the gun in his hand and then he grabbed the hand. And then apparently the Yaki Indian took the gun, shoved it into Manson's stomach and pulled the trigger like 5 times. Yeah. Like no hesitation.
Yeah.
Just was like, I'm going to fucking kill this guy. And then when it clicked, it was empty. It was like click, 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 click. And Manson like just smiled at him and the Yaki Indian was just like, you crazy, brave white man. Come, brave. Do mushrooms with us.
Come, let us trip the light fantastic together.
God, it's amazing. He transcended sexual orientation, race, all with crazy.
Yeah, all of just the earth crazy.
We just got all these new Dark Side of the Moon vinyls, and we hear they are extra cool if you play backwards.
That is brilliant.
Look at our velvet painting of bull riders. You will love them.
Is it not trippy as balls? Very cool, tiny white man.
Please, let us pause and go to Gadzooks for more black lights.
Yeah, you never see a Native American at Gadzooks. Why is that? They should be there more.
So Charlie gets sent back to prison. He gets sent back to prison, a 10-year sentence, and he starts looking back on his life, falls into a deep depression. He starts studying all kinds of different things. He starts studying Islam, psychology, hypnotism, and surprisingly enough, the one thing that spoke to him more than anything else, Scientology.
That makes sense. He's crazy. He's an insane
person.
And
also, Scientology is how he picked up several members of the Manson family.
Yeah.
Is that they were people that were already interested in, because we've talked about it a little bit. We have to do a whole episode about Scientology.
Oh, and we're definitely gonna.
But it started as sort of a street philosophy where people were really selling it on the street. I guess they're doing it now the same way, but it was like, it was kind of like a hip thing.
Yeah.
If you knew about Dianetics.
Yeah. All the stars were doing it immediately. That was L. Ron Hubbard's big trick. I mean, it was a brilliant move.
Yes, it was.
I think he said a star is equal to 100,000 people, something like that.
Yeah. So he goes through all these different philosophies, but the thing that he finally decides on that's going to change his life, the one thing that he's going to dedicate his life to, his music.
Yes, and what good music he created.
It's all right.
That's why I said good. I said it was good.
But yeah. It just sounds like he became such a fucking dickhead about his music immediately.
Right.
Because he's always just like, my music was my passion. I played music everywhere I went. I didn't care what people said. I showed them my music. As soon as I met them, I was like, oh, you got to hear me play the guitar. And can then you imagine being dragged into a cell with Charles Manson? Baby Charles Manson. Just staring at you as he plays the fucking guitar and you have to go like, it's good.
You gotta go like that too, otherwise you are dead.
Yeah. So Charlie, and this is another central part of Charlie Manson and what's behind the Manson murders. So John Douglas, who wrote the book Manhunter, which is one of the most famous true crime books that's ever been written, this guy was part of the behavioral sciences unit, and he actually believed, and I take this guy at his word, that Charlie's main motivation in all of this was to be a rock star. To be a musician. That was the driving force behind everything that he did.
He literally technically the Manson family was like Twitter followers. He thought that but he thought that having this group, like when we'll get to that point, but like he was like, oh, now I'm in. Once I already have my fucking hot chicks that are, you know, Manson level hot chicks. And they were
pretty hot.
Yeah.
Squeaky is hot.
Squeaky's super fucking
hot. Yeah.
Yeah. And so was Lindsay. Lindsay Van Houten is also very attractive.
Yeah, that's Leslie Van Houten.
All
Leslie.
You need is two, and then the other girls just kind of dance around, but then you think, oh, they're all hot.
No, it started with a librarian, but we'll get to that here in a bit. Yeah, yeah. It started with a librarian with copious body hair. So oh, yeah. we'll get to that later. But he, while he was in prison, he learned a lot about guitar from a guy named Alvin Creepy Karpus, who was convicted of 14 murders while he was a part of the Ma Barker gang in the 30s.
Oh, all right. And he was a very good guitar player?
He was a great guitar. He played steel guitar, mostly, you know, like country music.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Charlie learned a lot of folk from him. And another important thing to remember about him and his music, Charlie was in prison from 1960 until 1967. He fucking missed the 60s.
He's making up for time.
The vast majority of it, like, his music taste was stuck in the 1950s. He was playing that kind of stuff. And, of course, he learns all this stuff from Creepy Karpus, which is more like kind of country type stuff.
Oh, yeah, and his stuff is from the 30s. So yeah. It's all like, hey there, Mr. Biscuit, can you put my shoes in my wallet? Oh, Mr. Biscuit. Like, all the worst songs.
At least it wasn't like the 20s, because there's no way you can get all those tubas and all those other big band music instruments in there.
No.
That's tough. The guitar is a perfect prison instrument.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Yeah, it's not as annoying as the harmonica.
Oh, no. Ugh. I always had to play that, what was that thing called there? Not the flute, the white trash flute.
The recorder?
The recorder.
God damn, 330-pound Ben Kissel with a tiny, tiny recorder.
You can leave now, Ben.
Okay, thank you.
I'll never learn the recorder. Smashes the recorder.
I did smash it.
So in June of 66, he was transferred back to Terminal Island. And Terminal Island, at this point, a lot of this is a time of, you know, Johnny Cash live at Folsom Prison. This was a time when musicians would regularly go to prisons to try out new material and to try out new band members.
Right.
This happened quite a bit. And this happened up until, this was still going on in the 80s or in the 70s. If you watch this great documentary called Heartworn Highways, you see David Allan Coe going to a prison to play for all of these guys. And of course,
all of his friends that he was previously in prison with.
He did know a couple guys he was playing
with. I'm sure he did.
Yeah, yeah. He
so Manson
did.
Was probably just like, they're all coming to me.
Yeah.
I'm the smart one. I'm already here.
He legitimately thought that. He was just like, this is the best place for me, man.
Yeah.
Coming through here, you know, it's like nothing. No, definitely what they want to hire is a 5'4", like, tiny, wiry, crazy-eyed man who's crazed by the fucking steel guitar.
So at 7 years after Charlie got there, they release him from prison. Only problem was Charlie didn't want to go. Like,
he wanted to stay in prison.
He asked them, like, can I stay? Please let me stay.
So sad.
I'm so happy here. Because all he was doing was writing and performing music. He said that performing music was the only time he was ever confident in himself. The first time in his life that he was ever confident in himself.
Oh, it wasn't when he had the razor blade to the guy's throat as he was butt-banging him?
I don't think
no confidence there.
I don't think there was much confidence.
It wasn't a confidence move.
Yeah, it seems like a confident move to me. I don't know.
So they gave him $35 and a suitcase of old clothes. And at this point, he had spent more than half of his life behind bars. And his prison conduct sheet at the time of his release said, and this is a perspective of Charlie that Charlie doesn't necessarily have of himself at this time. His prison conduct sheet said, he has a pattern of criminal behavior and confinement that dates to his teen years. This pattern is one of instability, whether in a free society or a structured institutional community. Little can be expected in the way of a change in his attitude, behavior, or mode of conduct.
Oh, man, they didn't mention my music. God damn it.
Yes, and he's a very promising singer-songwriter who should definitely go seek out famous record producers in Los Angeles.
There's also no way that he's going to help kill Sharon Tate. So send him free.
So he gets out in 1967. It's the Summer of Love. And Charlie's like right smack dab in the middle of it. And like I said,
the Summer of Love had no idea what was coming for it. That's what's so awesome. I do love Charlie for
period too, because this in the later 60s, as it was heading towards the 70s, that the San Francisco scene, or like the whole hippie movement, was already beginning to take a turn for the right.
Oh, everyone, yeah, after 5 years of doing mushrooms every damn day, your brain starts to go crazy and the society crumbles around you.
Yeah, the Summer of Love was the peak. The rise and fall of the hippie music, or the hippie movement, the true one, is fast. It's like real fucking fast.
Yeah,
it rises
you can only
and
trip
falls.
For so long.
It rises and falls in a period of about 6 years or so. It doesn't last very long. So Charlie, he missed all the 60s, but he just heard that Haight-Ashbury was the happening scene down in San Francisco. So he goes down there, shines shoes for a while, and he said that a 15-year-old kid turned him onto the scene.
I mean, did they even wear shoes?
He's like, hey there, wild-eyed crazy man. You ever heard of a band called The Grateful Dead? Check them out. They're pretty good.
Yeah, shine my...
You gotta do, like, what you gotta do when you see them is do this stuff called acid. I'm not really sure. I'm 15. You know, I'm just trying to go to school. I'm trying to be a president. My name's Bob Dole. Robert Dole.
Untold
story.
Yep. And Charlie Manson did actually take his first hit of acid at a Grateful Dead concert.
All right.
And he said he loved it.
I'm not surprised.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Time really of did. His life. So he was one of those guys around Haight-Ashbury that would just wander around playing his music for anyone that would listen. He'd go into bars and ask the bartender, he's like, hey, could I just play for some tips? And if nobody gave him any money, he'd put on his loudest voice and say,
I just got out of prison, and me and my two partners had come by this place to rob it. I'd talk my partners into letting me try to earn a few honest dollars instead of robbing the place. Now, if some of you bastards don't put a few dollars into this empty hat so that I ain't a liar, I don't know how long I can keep my two partners from walking through that door with their shotguns.
And he said,
it was surprising how effective those words were.
Yes, technically, Mr. Manson, that is robbery, actually, at this point now.
I swear to God, everything that Charlie Manson says sounds like a fucking Murder Fist sketch.
Yeah. It really does. I mean, that's what's so...
It's because he has the same logic. He has the same Murder Fist logic.
Right.
Which is just being like, it's like, how do I... I gotta be an honest man. What am I gonna do? I gotta crime my way to it.
Right. That's crazy. He took acid at the Grateful Dead concert. Everyone up there for the Grateful Dead is just having a great time thinking about peace and love, and they don't even realize they're entertaining the person who was going to end their entire movement.
Yeah.
That's weird. When you're an entertainer, when you're in a band or a comedian or a sketch group, you never know who's in the crowd. You might be making a serial rapist or a serial killer just love you. Like Murder Fist, I'm sure after a Murder Fist sketch show, there was at least one person who goes up to Henry and be like, man, you're my favorite comedian. You're so goddamn funny. And in 3 weeks, we're going to read in the paper he had a bunch of babies in a cement box underneath his apartment.
Please, last podcast on the left, listeners, if you are having any thoughts of murder or anything criminal, please seek help.
But I will say, I think that anybody within a 5-foot radius of Charlie knew that he was going to be a murderer. You know what I mean? Like, knew that he was going to be bad, especially at that concert when he was just, like, dancing, like, a little too hard. A touch of gray, you know?
So eventually, Charlie made his way up to UC Berkeley just to play a few songs, and he met...
Oh, he didn't enroll? He's not going to go.
No, he's
not going to Berkeley? Oh.
Not going to Berkeley. And he meets the very first member of the Charlie Manson family, Mary Bruner, a.k.a. Mariochi, Ouch, Mother Mary, Mary Manson, Linda D. Manson, and Christine Marie Ukes.
That's the one that's the name that I don't know where that name comes from. I don't know how you get the nickname of Christine Marie Ukes.
Yeah, Ukes sounds like something that would go with a southern breakfast or something.
You know, all the Manson family, they all had their straight alias. Well, at least most of them did. They had that name, like, because they got arrested a lot for having false ID.
That
they would just throw around, and they did, but they all did get arrested.
I'm gonna be Starcrust Manson and Catherine Blubbard.
Hi, hello, my name is Robert Moontree Pemberton.
Okay, Mr. Pemberton.
So Mary Bruner, she was a librarian who had just moved to California from Wisconsin.
Explains the hair.
Yeah. She didn't have many friends.
Wisconsin women are beautiful.
They are beautiful. I love every single one of them. And if you're from Wisconsin, you are for me.
So Charlie talks his way into letting her stay, or letting him stay at her apartment. After a few weeks, they started sleeping together. And as Charlie described it, it's just a beautiful courtship.
But this is actually kind of romantic. A few weeks. I mean, he didn't aggressively sexually assault her or anything. Like, no. I mean.
Well, that's what Charlie said. He said that you know, everybody paints me as coming out and immediately starting to fuck all these women. But I tell you what, it was quite a few days before I got my balls out of Hawk.
But then he didn't. Not exactly romantic.
Literally 4 days.
Yeah, four days.
Because he really had his. He had his fucking way with women, and it's true. Is that I think honestly, he was just. He was good on the bush.
Yeah,
he was good on that bush.
Well, you know, in fact, he's went on about the first sexual experience between him and Mary Bruner in Manson, in his own words. He goes on about it for 3 pages.
3 pages.
It is 3 pages of erotic literature.
It's like a 50 Shades of Grey situation.
No, it's very. It's like very sensual. It's very delicate. He talks about how he learned how to please a woman. It's all about pleasing the woman and how to go on a journey with her. And this
if we could please get one of our amazingly talented Last Podcast on the Left fans who can create the graphic art. I would love to see Manson's face on the cover of those romantic novels instead of Fabio or these other big buff models.
It's really true. And again, up to this point, Charles Manson is kind of a cool guy. Like, he's kind of a mess, and he's like a very, like, he's got to be rough to have a fucking conversation with, but he's got a cool pass.
Right.
He eats that tush 24/7.
Everyone
knows
was on
how to
drugs.
Talk good talk.
Yeah, he does,
he'd
man.
He'd be fun to hang out with.
Yep.
Now, was he up front with his criminal past to these people?
Absolutely.
How he got them. Yeah, that's how he got people.
That's how he was
there.
A cool dude. You know, he's like, yeah, I'm a criminal. I've been in prison. You know, I know the ways of
establishment. Yeah.
But he said that experience taught him that, quote, sex is more than a stiff dick and a hot box.
That's nice.
Which I just think that's a great thing to teach your kids.
Yep, sex is
but
more
this
than
is also, mm-hmm. This is where he also sort of began his fucking guru rap.
Yeah.
Was during this time. Where's that, like, while they were having sex, and he would just be like, you are God. I am God. We are all our own gods. We are made of the universe. And it was like, started this thing, which was just like awesome during sex.
Yeah.
And then he started realizing, I can use this all the time.
Yeah.
That's exactly the way that Pastor Joel Osteen started his ministry as well. And now he's selling out Yankee Stadium. So think
about
that. Yeah,
but it started with like a 4-year-old boy.
Yes.
Telling him that you are Clifford the Red Dog. I am Clifford the Red Dog.
We're both Clifford the Red Dog, which is kind of gross.
He also brings the 16-year-old girl named Darlene into the mix, who doesn't really stick around with the family all that long. But he loved the power that all this gave him. But he would fuck Darlene during the day and then fuck Mary at night. And the power that he was able to have over these women, how he was able to essentially hypnotize both of them, he fucking loved it. It gave him the confidence to deal with people.
Right.
In a non-prison setting.
Sure.
Which we're also going to see here, too, are the seeds that are planted. That, like, honestly, of all of the people that you can compare Charles Manson to, I would compare him to, like, Hitler. I would say that it's the same thing because he's got an inferiority. No, I'm not saying on scale.
I'll agree with it. No, not on a scale, but as far as personality goes, fairly similar.
He's got an inferiority complex that expresses itself in the way that it did, because it's all about control and power, and nothing is, and because his sexual desires are being satisfied, like when Hitler had like Jewish girls pee all over him, you know.
No,
your
he
grandfather
liked the dump. Yeah,
your grandfather was feeding him Gatorade.
yeah, my granddad was on Gatorade duty. I think that's actually that's where it all began.
Vata boy.
Like many technologies that started in Germany.
She's getting so parched. I can tell from her urine.
Yeah. Haterade there. Classic. Yeah.
And Charlie, I mean, he fully admits. He said at this time, he said, I was aggressive, adventurous, and felt like I understood the minds of most of the kids that flooded the streets. Like, he knew, it's like, all right, I get these kids. Because these kids, they're disaffected. They feel like they're rejected by society. They're searching for something. A lot of them are runaways.
Right.
A lot of them have criminal pasts. But he, not long after this relationship, he hooks up with this reverend named Dean Morehouse, who gave him a ride while he was hitchhiking. And this guy, Morehouse, gives Charlie a piano. And Charlie took the piano and traded it for a cheap Volkswagen van. And so at this point, the Manson family is mobile. Bruner quits her job, and they start to just drift around California, meeting other women.
I think it would have been cooler if he would have just put tires on the piano. You know, just roll around that. I could see the Manson family like the Chuck E. Cheese group.
Slowly turns into a Snoopy like thing, where he's like riding the top of it. It's got like a steering wheel.
Now, did anyone learn how to play this damn thing?
Yeah, he
but
said.
But we will say that this is, you were right here in your assessment too. It's like this is what made the Manson family, quote unquote, possible.
Yeah.
Was this van.
Yeah. It was that this is when recruitment could truly begin, because then they had a house, because this little Volkswagen bus was their home for the next about year and a half, until they got a hold of a black school bus. So,
which is honestly, if you are looking to escape your house in Wisconsin or Minnesota or some rural parts of the South, the idea of rolling around the West Coast inside of a black school bus is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And a van is like, okay, but that's a hell of an upgrade.
Yeah, a van's all right. So they wandered around for a while. They wandered around Southern California. They go down to L.A., where a former prison contact told him that he could set him up with a producer. So Charlie calls up the studio contact.
Just Los Angeles. That's all of Los Angeles. It is. That is like what Los Angeles is as a whole. Of just like a guy, a criminal promising you that he has connections to a record producer. And then you show up and a guy with a fucking like jukebox costume on fucking steals your wallet.
Exactly.
Yes, because the studio contact was, quote, out of town. For a few days. Yeah, he's out of town. So Charlie just, you know, they wander around L.A. where he meets a young, freckled, red-haired girl named Lynette, a.k.a. Squeaky Frome.
Now, Lynette Frome is like literally, Squeaky Frome is a woman out of time.
Yeah.
She is a woman that it's just like, because we were going to do this a while ago and we never did it, but I want I also see that too. If she existed and there was like an OKCupid profile of Squeaky Frome, it would blow up.
That would be huge.
She would just be exactly what you wanted. You know, she'd be like, you know, easygoing girl looking for a good time, just want somebody to stare at the stars with and, you know, and eat my pussy while calling me Jesus.
Right.
Squeaky Frome.
Oh, like, yeah. Redheaded, cute, approachable. Squeaky Frome,
innocent.
Oh man, I definitely would have sent a message to her on OKCupid. Definitely would have swiped right on the old Tinder.
She would have been thrilled with it, Marcus.
And thank you, Judith, for photoshopping that wonderful photo of me coming to the rescue of Squeaky Frome, or carrying her out of a courthouse after she made quite a mess in there.
She was
not complicit in any of the murders, but in 1975, she did pull a gun on Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford.
She pulled the gun on. The gun didn't go off.
Well, of course not, because it's Gerald Ford. Everything went wrong around that guy. Fell down constantly. The man was a goof.
Yep. And she was sentenced to life in prison for that.
Right, that would do that.
So as a kid, she was a performer in a popular local dance group called the Westchester Lariats.
Can you
50s?
Imagine being forced to go see the fucking Westchester Lariats on a Sunday? Can you imagine just... All right, let's go see the fucking Lariats again.
I actually think people probably loved it. It's Westchester. Yeah,
she was on the Lawrence Welk show.
There you go.
She performed at the White House.
Wow.
For two, and one for me.
God, I love this show.
Just go, take off your shirt.
And here's a really interesting fact that I had no idea about. And this is another interesting thing about the Manson family, is that they have a lot of connections at one point in their life to famous people. Squeaky Frome was friends with Phil Hartman in high school.
Yeah, that was insane.
Yeah.
The late, great Phil Hartman from SNL.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. That story, isn't that ended tragically.
Isn't it weird that Squeaky Frome lived longer than Phil Hartman?
I don't want to, Henry, I don't like the joke, Henry. It's still too soon. Phil Hartman's psycho wife from North Dakota, cocaine fiend. That's why you can't marry someone who also wants to be famous. They get jealous.
Never
of
marry
success.
A fun person.
Never.
That's the moral of that story.
Yeah. Do and blow. For a little while, it's a great time staying up all night, banging all the time, and the next thing you know, you want to go to sleep, but she doesn't. And then you die
and
die.
Yeah, so
she
uses the permanent alarm clock that wakes you up into heaven.
The old revolver to God.
And of course, Squeaky, she was not a happy teenager. She worked at a canvas shop where coworkers would see her burn herself with lit cigarettes. She'd shoot staples into her forearms.
I would have been friends
with her. Staple gun.
Definitely. I was friends with a girl who did that exact same thing.
Yeah. I was in love with the girl in junior high school that carved Kurt into her arm. That was like the hottest thing to me. I thought she was so cool.
Like Kurt Loader?
Kurt Loader.
Fucking Loader.
Big MTV News fan.
Big MTV News. Yeah. It was actually, it was Kurt Douglas is what she kept saying. And I was like, it's Kirk Douglas. And she's like,
no, it's Kurt. Yeah.
So in high school, Squeaky, she started getting rebellious, started taking drugs, drinking a lot. She got into an argument with her father over the definition of a word. And so she packed her bags and left home for the final time.
Lord, what a powder keg. That must have been every dinner.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, what the fuck are we going to argue about tonight?
Yeah. The word was father, and they disagreed with what it took to be a good one.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah, that was just sad, Ben, because that seems like that could be very likely what it actually was.
Yeah, it was probably like, what does it mean to be a dad? He's like, I've taken care of you. And she's like, you haven't eaten me.
You don't care about me.
You don't care.
Because, again, a big thing you're going to see, we're going to see as a pattern with all of these women, too, is that they that standard, like, feels out of place. Feels like they don't have a group, feel like they don't belong, feel like they don't, like, you know, they don't belong to their families, they don't belong to society.
Right.
And Charlie kind of got this ability from prison. They said basically it should have probably came from prison, which is like instant reading of people.
Yeah.
Of being able to like pick out who's vulnerable and put his point of view directly in their heads. And they are ready to like join up with him.
And keep in mind,
they're
this is the 60s. We're still in the 60s, maybe early
70s. This is 1967.
1967. This is well before Ted Danson ran a bar called Cheers. You know, so these people didn't know where to go. They didn't have any other place to be where everyone knew their name.
If
you know,
only
this was
Cheers
it.
Existed then, Sharon Tate would be making, I don't know, Devil in the Details 3 or something.
Oh, my. Devil in the Details is one of my favorite franchises. That is a great one.
So Squeaky ended up in Venice Beach. She met Manson. Of course, he charmed her. And Squeaky...
God, I would love to see Manson on Venice Beach and Muscle Beach.
Oh, man.
Yeah, look at him. Yeah, yeah. They think they're tough. They think they're strong. Huh?
They're not strong. They don't know the strength of the mind, my friend. They don't know the trip that I'm on.
Just stares at the barbell for like 15 minutes trying to raise it. Yeah, not today. Okay.
So she goes on the road, becoming the second member of the Manson family, along with Mary Bruner. Of course, the music contact never got in touch with Charlie. So they go back on the road. And this is the time when he's introduced to the concept of commune living. Which, of course, would be put into place with disastrous results later on. And this is also when he started proselytizing to young people about his philosophies. This is when, I mean, they were never really solidified all that much. Of course, there was Helter Skelter and the race war and all that type of stuff. But this
that
is,
was later
this
on.
Is
that
like
was the final.
This is rough drafts. Like, this is what, he admitted he liked the feeling of power, and he maintains.
If you see a starfish that's on top of a mailbox, you could make a wish. And then he's saying also random shit like that.
That's true.
That's
Yes, and he maintains that he did nothing but good, quote, other than nailing a few underage broads who were already giving their bodies to whoever they fancied.
Well, that is pedophilia, technically. But.
No. He fucked a lot of underage girls.
Yeah.
And maintains in many cases that, they loved it.
I'm sure that he does maintain that.
This is Charlie's story.
Yes, that is definitely Charlie's story. So the next member was Patricia Krenwinkle, a.k.a. Big Patty, a.k.a. Yellow, a.k.a. Marnie Reese.
Why you guys call me Big Patty?
Because she's big.
That's such a
bad. Can we call me Delicate Patty? It's like, your name's Patty.
Yeah, you're big, so you're Big Patty.
Yeah. But she was known most commonly of the family as Katie. She's the one that wrote the infamous Death to Pigs on the wall of the La Bianca's house. And
she was just thinking about food.
And she was also
she
the one.
Right, bacon is my favorite.
I heart bacon.
Said right, death to pigs. She also is a. I saw an interview with her now. Like she came out. It's like it was in 2000. I think it was in 2004. She did this interview for the New York Times. And I was watching it, and she's like, she couldn't be more remorseful now. And it's just, it's so full of shit.
Yeah.
Every time I meet, I understand they were manipulated by Charlie, but also he was a 5'4" maniac. You have to, there has to be a lot of suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
To be bought, to live with Charlie.
Huge disconnect. Yeah. She was also the one who misspelled Helter Skelter.
Yeah, which is embarrassing to say
the
least.
She had one job.
One job.
Yeah, she put Helter Skelter on the fridge.
That's just devastating.
Yeah. She's also the longest serving female in the California penal system.
How long has she been there for?
God, she's been there since 1974, 72.
Because she got convicted of 7 murders. Yeah. And then, it was like her and a group of, like an inmate support group. And they're like, all right, let me just guess which one of us, she's a woman talking to a group of them, basically saying, who's been up for the parole the most times? And then Patty raised her hand, and they're all like, like laughing about it. And I was like, she killed 7 people.
Well, Fat Patty, she's funny though.
You're not laughing when Ted Bundy does it. It's just because she looks like a cute old grandma now. Yeah. But it's like, she was a fucking maniac.
She stabbed Abigail Folger, the heiress to the Folger coffee fortune. She stabbed her so many times that the cops, when they found her body, thought that her white dress was red.
Well, that is the worst part of going to sleep. Folgers is the best part of waking up, but then getting stabbed to death, that is a different commercial. Holy Lord.
So she suffered from low self-esteem.
She was
teased for being overweight.
Because she's fat. She should have lost weight. That's what you do when you're teased for being fat. You lose weight and you succeed in life.
So she also had excessive growth of body hair, which was caused by an endocrine condition. And she had taught Sunday school in the past, and she'd even thought at one point of becoming a nun.
How is a person who proves the fact there is no God because he made her fat and hairy trying to teach kids that there is one?
I don't care about body hair, but if you have to specifically mention in every single thing you read about a person named Patty Crunchwinkle, the fact that she has excessive body hair, that's got to be a lot.
It's
excessive. Like, I don't care. I don't care whether you shave or not, but if it's like hanging out of your hat, like if you have to shave your forehead to go to the grocery store, you just become a wolf woman. A wolf woman.
Everyone has body hair. Everyone can jump. It doesn't mean we're Kevin Durant. You know, it's like this woman was like, she's like an all-star. She's a pro of body hair.
Yeah. So she met Charles Manson in Manhattan Beach in 1967. Squeaky and Mary, they were already along for the ride. They were already known as Charlie's girl. During those famous interviews, Krenwinkel said that she slept with Manson the first night they met, and that he was the first person that ever told her that she was beautiful. After they slept together, she put her head in his lap. She cried, and she said, "Charlie, you've given me a new world. Anything you do has to be right.
God, it's
take me with you wherever you go."
It's a bizarro Charles Angels, isn't it? It really is just like...
Well, Manson kind of harps on that for a while, just being like, where do you think the fucking Charlie's Angels name even came from? It came from me. They've been biting off my style for years. That's my trip, man.
Right, yeah.
Yep, so she hops in the... She quits her job, leaves her apartment, her car behind, hops in the van, goes down to San Francisco, and Charlie said at this point, he said, the party was mine everywhere we traveled. So he is having the time of his life. Lifestyle is, man... I mean, because he spent half his life in fucking prison.
Right.
Fucking dudes.
And really, again, they don't teach you anything in prison. The fact that he has gotten this much success is pretty... he could have actually been a successful person if his mother wasn't a prostitute and he wasn't abused since he was born.
You have this tiny, creepy man showing up with everywhere he goes with this flock of women that are all like magic women. They're all like running around and like dancing and taking drugs and freely sexual. And it's like, that's an incredible package. He's walking...
Yeah.
You see that guy pull up to your town, and he's got these cute girls with him. He's got a guitar. He's got a little glitter in his eye.
Yeah.
You're gonna talk to that guy. You're gonna listen to that guy, especially in 1967.
If he was in Libya, he would have become the dictator. He's Gaddafi, for Christ's sake.
So next he picked up Bruce Davis, a.k.a. Jack Paul, who was briefly considered a suspect in the Zodiac killings.
Oh. I was also considered a yeah. suspect in the Zodiac killings.
A pulse yeah. would do it.
Yeah, Manson, he liked having another dude around. And also the guys, you know, they had a lot in common. Davis, he was a musician. He had an interest in Scientology. He was an ex-con. So these guys were real fast friends.
That just shows you it's just it's like sometimes women can, like, he's having sex with all these women.
Yeah.
And even he's just like, can I get a guy? Can I just get a dude in here so I can have a conversation?
God! Like, can't talk to anybody about the fucking Packers, man.
Yeah, Manson loved the Green Bay Packers. Huge fan.
So this guy Davis, he'd drift in and out of the Manson family for a few years. He even would, he would head up the London branch of the Scientology, London Scientology branch. For all he got kicked out of that, he came back to the Manson family, and he was implicated in the murder of the stuntman over on the Spawn Ranch, which of course we'll get to later. So in Nevada, the crew, they got rid of the van. They picked up the old black school bus, which they would drive around in for the next 18 months or so. You know, and people would drop in and out. He said at one point there were like 20 people living in this van, like just cramped and packed. But he said that his music reflected that it was the happiest time in their life. And, of course, he tries to go and give the music contact another try. and the producer surprisingly agreed to meet with him this time.
Yeah.
As they were heading back down there, they picked up Susan Atkins, a.k.a. Sadie Mae Glutz, a.k.a. Sexy Sadie, a.k.a. Donna K. Powell.
Now,
AKA
how come she
Sharon
gets to be
Kate.
Sexy Sadie and I'm Fat Patty? This doesn't make any sense.
Big Patty. Patty.
It's different names. It's how it goes. Fat Patty's got a fun little rhyming scheme. It's Sexy Sadie, it's kind of cool.
It's a Beatles. It's a Beatles song. You love the Beatles, right? You don't want us to miss out on a Beatles song name, do you? Come on, Big Patty.
I've been trying to lose weight. You know that.
So Susan Atkins, she had dropped out of school and moved to San Francisco. She met a couple of escaped convicts there and hit the road with them. They committed
just
a bunch
sound
of
like fun women.
Yeah,
they do.
A little unpredictable.
Unpredictable. Unpredictable Manson women. So they hit the road. They committed a lot of armed robberies up and down the West Coast. They were caught in Oregon. The men were sent to prison. Susan got probation after serving 3 months in jail. And when she was released, she went down to San Francisco, got work as a topless dancer. It was there that she danced in a show called The Witch's Sabbath, which was organized by Church of Satan founder Anton LaVey.
Wow.
What I would have given to have been there.
Yeah,
that must have been so much fun.
Yeah. So Susan met Manson at a party, listened to his music, fell in love with it. A few minutes later, slept with Charlie, quit her job, and joined the group.
Damn.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is so now we're coming back to the Morehouse family, which if you'll remember, Reverend Dean Morehouse was the guy that gave Charlie the piano that he was able to trade for the VW van, which eventually gave him the power to recruit and to get the Manson family together. Apparently, Charlie wasn't done with him for Reverend Dean Morehouse's 14-year-old daughter, Ruth Ann, a.k.a. Weesh, a.k.a. Ruth Ann Hubelhurst, a.k.a. Rachel Susan Morris, was infatuated with Charlie. After the Tate murder, she said that she knew of 10 more murders other than Sharon Tate. Charlie had originally taken Ruth Ann out shortly after taking the piano. They'd go to the beach. She was 14. Charlie was 32. And when the first time they had sex, Ruth said, "But my daddy." And before she could say any more, Charlie whispered,
Forget your daddy. I'm your daddy. Doesn't this feel too good to be wrong?
Oh. And then, and then comment on this, he said, "You sent me all those children in the 60s who went through hell with me, yet she's the only one I took from you."
All right.
The only one.
The
yes.
only
he
one.
He considers that. He didn't consider it to be wrong. But he also considers it, like, he does.
He felt bad about that.
He's
one.
Like, yeah, I did fuck a 14-year-old girl when I was 32 years old.
That's gross.
I did do that. That was something that I did.
Yeah. Yikes. It's getting hot in here. Sorry.
That's what the lead singer of Blur is doing right now. Probably
Damon Albarn.
I have no idea who he is. Thought about Blur for some reason.
I don't know why you thought about the lead singer of Blur.
I don't know. What was that song they sang?
Song Woohoo.
That one.
That song. It makes you think of having sex with underage girls.
What? No.
So of course the family came for Manson, threatening to kill him, but Manson pretty much just tricked Dean into taking acid and then just sent him on his way. It's just like, you know what, man, you know, this is a whole trip. You know, this is the trip that I'm on right now. And, you know, you're on the God trip and I'm on the God trip too, but everybody's God. I'm God, you're God, your daughter's God, and God decided to have sex with God. God decided to go to the tree.
This will help you understand all of it.
Right.
Yeah. He pretty much just talked him around in circles while he was tripping balls on acid and sent him on his way. But according to Charlie, Dean came back weeks later, not to hurt him, but to get more acid. Because he loved that trip that Charlie was on.
Everybody loved the acid. Gotta lick something.
So it's
I gotta tell you, I'm sweating under my breasts, and that's the trip that I'm on.
Yep, the old sweaty underbreast trip. I love that one.
So it's at this time that the family comes across an infamous L.A. party house called the Spiral Staircase. And apparently there was devil worship going on here, satanic activities, animal sacrifice, blood drinking, a lot of whips and chains type of stuff, and rumors of human sacrifice. But of course, anytime satanic stuff comes around, there's going to be the rumors of human sacrifice. But Manson, he blames the Spiral Staircase, this house, for the turn that the family took from like the fun and games, love and sex type of lifestyle that they've been living for the last couple years into the madness that eventually overtook him. He described him as, quote, a hardcore multiple devil worshiping bunch of people.
You know, and I just feel like, you know, when a party goes on too long and it starts to get dark.
That's kind of what
this is that when you've been drinking and doing a lot of drugs and it starts getting that turn, that really weird turn. And this is where it basically happens for them and it switches their whole perspective. Because really at this point, it was a sex-based group.
Yeah,
right.
They were just trying, they were all having sex with each other and like doing free love and that's kind of the thing. And it just started taking this fucking turn. And then Charlie, being the con man who he is, it knows he has to be ahead of the curve, has to now instate himself as the leader of this devil worshiping group.
Right. Yeah. And they're all too fucked up to climb or climb down a spiral staircase anyway. So that's just a nightmare.
Absolutely.
It really just makes it a one-story house.
Yeah. This is when Charlie, he has his first vision of being a Christ-like figure. He said he was doing acid in this house, and he said a figure in a white robe told him, "Now, Charles, these are your loves, and you are their need." And then Charlie himself in the hallucination became the man in the white robe. And
how much acid?
So much acid.
Yeah, because he is looking around the room, and he believed that he was controlling every single aspect of the room. Like, he saw a guy that was looking at him sideways, and he said, you know, I made him fall down and break a lamp. And there was another guy, like there was a woman dancing in a hallway. It's like, I was thirsty, so I had her go get me a glass of water. She went and got him a glass of water. But he was so fucking high. So high.
Right.
And so after this strange episode another Christ-like thing. Manson, he was just wrapped in a dirty fucking white towel. He was washing a man's feet, which, you know, when you're in the middle of like a really weird fucking acid trip or a weird hallucinatory trip,
you start putting shit together for yourself.
Yeah, things just kind of start coming together. You start doing just weird shit was going. And Susan Atkins said, Charlie was dressed in a white robe, and I had so much love for him, I thought he was Jesus.
It was a shit-stained white towel.
Yes, it was. Yeah. But in response to this, Charlie said,
except maybe in jest. I mean, no one else ever said that shit. White towels, some very dirty feet, some words from a dope-talking ding-a-ling broad can lead a bunch of people into believing a guy is some kind of God. I feel there are a lot of people in this world who are crazier than most would like to believe I am.
So after things started to get weird sex-wise in this house, Charlie took the girls and left, although they returned many times over the next year or so. And he said, at that time, not in a million years could I have been convinced that things would turn out bloody and bad. And that's where we're going to end our first episode on Manson.
Not in a million years.
Not in a million.
Not in one million years. That thought wouldn't have crossed through his head.
Not in 1 million years do you think they would turn out bloody and bad.
You just thought the party was just, they were going to be bawling and laughing for forever, but then it turns out eventually things have to change, and then if you want to stay in charge of that group, you have to change too.
Yeah.
Right.
You will see that change.
God, he is. Who do you think? Koresh or Manson or Jim Jones? Beauty scale.
Best looking?
Who is it?
Charles Manson.
I'm giving it to Koresh, honestly.
That's a tough decision.
Jim Jones is an old man, kind of like bigger, puffier,
Manson
fatter
had the
face.
Eyes.
Yeah, Manson definitely had the eyes.
Bring into account height. bring into account height.
Mm, that is true. I'd imagine Koresh was... Yeah, I mean, if you're going for the full package. But, Charlie, better fashion sense.
That's very true, minus the...
And he played the guitar.
Poorly.
No, but, no, Koresh played the guitar, too. Remember, he was in a band. He was great.
And Jim Jones, he only played the slide whistle. Mm-hmm. Which is a problem.
Yeah. He's more of a public speaker type. So, ladies, go to the Facebook page and let us know. Koresh, Jones, or Manson, who do you think is the dreamiest?
So, in 2 days, tomorrow, it's Halloween.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's my favorite holiday, and I'm so happy I'm going to Atlanta to be for the last ever Atlanta Zombie Apocalypse. If you are in Atlanta, I suggest going tomorrow night to the Atlanta Zombie Apocalypse. It's going to be fucking nuts. Apparently, they have had several code greens this year.
What's
which
a code
means
green?
A code green is to throw up from fear.
No!
Nice! Oh, wow, awesome.
They've had several people throw up all over themselves.
That's perfect.
In the maze. So I'm excited for it.
Well, don't eat too much before you go in.
No, I'm gonna have a big slab of barbecue.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I'm really don't have excited. Those three hot dogs that you and Jackie had at Haunted Halloween.
Yeah. By the way, on the last roundtable, Jackie described her experience with you slightly different than you did, Mr. Zabrowski.
Oh, no. I said I was scared.
No, you did not. No, you did not.
I told the story about the fucking Dracula guy popping out, and I fell over the fucking stalactite and hurt my knee.
You said it was nothing but political correct garbage, just commercial nonsense.
You're a drunk.
It's 11 a.m. I'm possibly drunk.
Yes, possibly.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much. We'll do a hail yourselves.
Yes, hail you. And before we get out of here, don't forget to go to cavecomedyradio.com/lastpodcastontheleft for more episodes and to get your Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt. We just sent out our second batch yesterday. So if you ordered after we got our first batch, you'll be getting your t-shirts in a couple of days. The international people who didn't get theirs in the first batch are going to be getting theirs here in the next week or so. So if you want your Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt, go to cavecomedyradio.com/lastpodcastontheleft. There is a PayPal button there. It's $25 for domestic or $40 for overseas. And it's a fucking awesome shirt. Ben's wearing his right now, and it looks fucking awesome. I'm loving seeing all these people wearing these shirts out
there.
And
thank you guys.
It means a lot.
Thank you guys so much for your patience with that. You know, it's just us three doing this entire thing.
Yeah.
And, we're doing the best we can, and we just really appreciate you ordering, and we'll get them to you as quick as possible.
As quick as humanly fucking possible. So, yeah, thank you guys so much for all the t-shirts that you've ordered so far, and thank you in advance for the ones that you will order in the future.
All right, let's give it a Magustalation. Oh, I'm sorry, Henry.
And I just want to say hail Satan, everybody, again. Satan, I just want to put it out there. Satan, thank you for getting me through trials and tribulations. Thank you for giving me power in powerless situations. I love you, Satan.
You're sounding like Satan. A real Charles Manson there. Sounding like a real Charles Manson.
And Heil Geen.
All right.
Heil me!
All right, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
See you, fuckers.
Oh, happy Halloween. Yeah, we said happy Halloween.
Yeah, we said happy Halloween. Yeah, but still, happy Halloween again. Yeah, can never say it too much.
You can't. I love it.